learning can only ever be voluntary. Coercion is completely antithetical to knowledge creation. For anyone with a phone and internet connection, the possibilities are quite literally endless. What plans are you still working on that past you thought up as a good idea, but which no longer represent your present interests?
My guest today is Arjun Khemani. Arjun is a high school dropout and works at AirChat, an audio messaging network founded by Naval Ravikant and Brian Norgaard. Arjun and I talk about education, knowledge creation, AirChat, the power of the internet, and more. Given that Arjun is located in India on a completely opposite time zone, we thought we'd use AirChat to make a unique experimental episode. So this is a collection of a bunch of asynchronously recorded audio messages on the platform. The episode will probably feel different in a couple of ways, and it's also shorter than normal, but I had a ton of fun recording it, and I think you'll enjoy listening. So without further ado.
And everything I read or listened to about or by you, I didn't come across anything explaining how you got connected to Naval and Brian. So I'd love to start there and understand how it is you came to meet them and started working for AirChat. And then secondly, what have been your 1 to 3 biggest lessons that you've learned from them, either personally or in business?
Hey, Spencer. Thanks for having me on. It's great to talk to you asynchronously. So I was introduced to AirChat back in January this year by a friend of mine, Brett Hall. And at that time, AirChat was a closed app with a very small number of users. I was a big fan of Naval, as I still am. And we basically got into a DM discussion together. And I decided to seize the opportunity and proposed to work on AirChat. Naval then discussed it over with Brian, and they agreed to my proposal. Of course, I did have a back catalog of my work, including my writings and interviews I'd conducted, all published on the internet, and I was pretty active on Twitter, so I guess that helped. Something I'd say I learned from my time working at AirChat, and maybe this is a meta point about learning, but I'm around some really seasoned people right now, and I can just learn so much from their specialized knowledge, so I just need to keep my mind open and not be afraid of asking questions. Often we miss all these amazing opportunities in front of us because our mind is already fixed on an outcome we want. So we tend to just shut everything else out. And that's not really a good way to learn and make progress, because you can later realize that that outcome that you thought you really wanted wasn't what you expected it to be. So the journey matters a lot.
Between working on AirChat and hosting your own podcast, you're very well versed on the world of audio. What is it about AirChat as a platform and social technology that you think makes it uniquely suited to succeed? And then to steelman the other end, what do you think AirChat's shortcomings are or the reasons it might fail?
Yeah, so back when I joined AirChat, I was immediately fascinated by the platform. It facilitated having civil, high-quality conversations in a way I'd never seen any app do before. I guess a couple of the things I immediately loved about this platform was that it's async and people can respond at their own time. And AirChat isn't about broadcasting like most other social media apps are. It's primarily about people having conversations. And over here, you don't have to be a passive listener. As I like to say, AirChat is active audio. So if there's a conversation happening and there's something you want to say, you can just add a comment, which if the host thinks is good, they can promote it to the main chat, and you basically become a part of the conversation. I think what's missing on the internet is a place to have conversations, genuine civil conversations, and AirChat uniquely fills that gap. Success is not guaranteed, of course, which is the reason why we were doing it in the first place. There's many reasons we might fail. It's definitely not easy to build a new social network, but at the end of the day, I'm proud to be building a product that I genuinely want to use every day. And I'm meeting some of the best people in the world at what they do. So it's a fun journey, and it's something I'm excited and optimistic about every single day.
You're a high school dropout. In the US, dropping out is pretty uncommon. And in India, at least from my limited understanding, it's even more rare and carries an even greater social stigma. What were the realizations that led to the decision? And how'd you overcome that social pressure?
I think you're definitely right about there being a lot of pressure here in India to at least finish high school. For me, it was ultimately really an easy decision. I just couldn't stand school. It was everything against my philosophy of non-coercion and freedom and creativity, but I did have to face many obstacles in actually making that decision. My parents weren't on board with the idea, to put it mildly, so there was definitely a lot of convincing to do. And in a way, working at AirChat helped because that gave my parents some sense of confidence in me and in my decisions. One of my favorite moments at school was when, during a parents-teachers conference, my class teacher told my mom that, oh, Arjun has this unique views against school and authority, and that's fine, but he's instigating other students to disobey the school rules as well. And that, to me, was like the greatest compliment I had received. Although, to be fair, I don't think I had that much of an impact on the people around me. I wish I was even more vocal and freely expressing my disdain for authority. Might have converted some more people to the good side.
Staying on the theme of education and thinking about how we can improve it, what are the core tenets, functions, or elements that you think of when you think of a completely reimagined system for high school and onward?
I think education, like all other things, would really benefit from becoming fully privatized. But for a start, I would really like to see school becoming non-compulsory. So children should have a choice whether to go to conventional school or not. Learning can only ever be voluntary. I think coercion is completely antithetical to knowledge creation. And so the only way you can create knowledge or learn is by participating in the active process of conjecture and criticism. And school completely misses this point. Most people think our minds are like vessels that you can pour information into. And if you've regurgitated that information and you then pass a test paper on it, you've proven that you learned the subject. But that's not how knowledge creation works. There are, of course, a growing number of people who are homeschooling their children, and a number of edtech startups are being created that provide the service of personalized education. So there's definitely a shift taking place. So yeah, to answer your question, I don't think there's one system that works for all children. And many people talk about all the different subjects they think should be taught in school that aren't already included in the curriculum, for example, meditation or taxes. But I think that completely misses the point. School is the problem. It was meant to turn you into an obedient factory worker and now an obedient citizen. It takes over a child's freedom and hampers their learning process rather than facilitating it. We don't need a better school. We need voluntary networks for kids to pursue their own curiosity and carve their own individual paths to success.
I'm very much aligned on the idea that compulsory, coercive schooling is antithetical to learning, creativity, curiosity. And yet, to take this idea that school shouldn't be mandatory to an extreme, the idea of tens of millions of under 18-year-olds running around the streets of the U.S. between the hours of 8 and 3 might give a lot of people, adults in particular, pause. You had said you don't think there is a single model for everyone that we should allow, in effect, the private markets to determine the solutions that should be available. How do we reconcile the need for childcare, which is a massive function of the existing traditional and public education systems, with the notion that school should not be compulsory or learning should not be compulsory?
It's a common fallacy that the private sector can't provide the services the government currently provides for its people out of generosity. In fact, the private sector almost always does a better job than the government at providing people with what they want. And the government, in the first place, it never produces anything. It just redistributes other people's wealth. But Hayek famously called this the knowledge problem. One individual or a small group of individuals can't possibly know the needs and desires of hundreds of millions of people. And so the best way to solve that is for people who are aware of their circumstances to freely make decisions themselves and communicate the desires to entrepreneurs by buying or not buying specific products or services that then signal to entrepreneurs what they should produce, at what price, and at what quantity. And this principle is true for any kind of product or service. I think you've spoken to Chris Turner on your podcast. I haven't listened to the episode yet, but I know he's building a company called Moonrise, which is a co-learning space for kids. And yeah, I understand working adults can't stay around their children the whole day, but there are more desirable alternatives to school to solve that problem. And what's really extreme to me is that some ignorant group of folks decide to create an institution mandating all parents to send their children to for 40 hours a week, where all the children are basically taught a fixed curriculum despite their will. That's what's really extreme to me. I just want kids and people to be able to do what they want to do without empowering someone else to do the same. And some years ago, it was normal to view women in a similar manner. Women weren't allowed to do whatever they wanted to do, and it was absurd if you'd let your wife or daughter do whatever she wanted to do just a few generations ago. But we made progress as a society, and I'm optimistic that we'll shift towards a better view of children as well.
Staying on this theme of curiosity, what would you say the arrow of your curiosity or the direction of it has been in recent years and why?
Recently, I've grown really interested in the subject of Austrian economics, which basically stemmed from my interest in Popperian epistemology, or just epistemology, I should say. I think Austrian economics is really the natural next step from what Karl Popper proposed and what David Deutsch improved upon. So yeah, thinking about progress and how to make more of it and make it faster, what's the best way for society to organize? That's what's been fascinating to me right now.
I believe in one of your blog posts, you said that people need to be able to, and I quote, live with uncertainty and embrace error correction and creativity, end quote. It's that uncomfortable, unfamiliar territory that new insights and growth are derived from. And yet, that's not how most people are wired. We want to protect our downside and mitigate uncertainty. Is there a unique positioning or perspective to the struggle that you feel like you have and could share that might reorient people towards embracing uncertainty?
I should first mention what certainty really is. When someone says they're certain about something, they're essentially describing a feeling. It's not something objective. No matter how certain you feel, you can always be mistaken. People crave certainty, and I think that's a big problem in today's modern world. I recently tweeted something like, certainty is a bigger barrier to progress than ignorance is. And I think that's true. Certainty impedes upon error correction, which is the only way to make progress. But if you recognize that you can be mistaken, then you're open to new ideas, new solutions, and essentially making progress.
You're a massive fan of David Deutsch, and for those who are familiar, a lot of his ideas come through in your speaking and writing. I don't know if you were summarizing his work or quoting him, but you tweeted at one point that his moral imperative, and I quote, is, if all knowledge is conjectural and subject to improvement, then protecting the means of improving knowledge is more important than any particular piece of knowledge, end quote. How can we improve the protection and unlocking of improving knowledge?
That's a great quote and a great question. There are a lot of enemies of Western civilization and the Enlightenment, and prosperity is never guaranteed. Progress is not inevitable. I think the way to preserve the means of error correction is to reject bad philosophy. We should reject dogmatism and relativism and foundationalism, which are all essentially ways to seize progress by establishing some truth. It ties back to the desire for certainty. Certainty is just a feeling, and it's illusory. We should instead embrace the fact that we are fallible and can always improve our knowledge by creatively criticizing our existing knowledge. Nothing is out of bounds, and we don't have to accept any false foundations.
I think similar to me, you straddle these two simultaneous pursuits, and I think that's part of why I gravitated to you and wanted to interview you. Those two pursuits are, first, the pursuit of knowledge or better explanations or the following of curiosity. It's kind of characterized by your writing and podcasting and work with AirChat. And then maybe the other is the pursuit of truth, of capital T truth, in the sense of truth-seeking, non-dual awareness, and whatever you want to call it. You've also previously said that becoming a monk is the best career option on the market, which I loved. How do you wrestle with the search for truth, but knowing that you have to live with different incomplete maps or explanations of reality? Do you compartmentalize those searches, and maybe how do they conflict, or what tension arises between them?
Yeah, I think my views have changed a bit on this. I think seeking good explanations is what I'd call the search for capital T truth. But again, there's no final truth, only better explanations. And the search for better explanations isn't just limited to the field of science. We can make boundless progress in all realms of knowledge, and we should.
One interpretation of what spiritual leaders and mystics might call awakening is that you are dissolving or transcending that thing which desires to do the knowledge creation and uncertainty mitigation. Are you saying that that capital T truth is non-existent, a better explanation, or some third thing that I haven't articulated?
So I think the capital T kind of truth does exist, but we cannot ever attain it. I think it was Xenophanes who said, even if by chance man were to utter the final truth, he himself would not know it, for all is but a woven web of guesses. My view here stems from fallibilism, which is the alternative to dogmatism and relativism, in that it endorses the idea that no truth is final and that people can always improve upon their knowledge. I think the spiritual teachers who believe the self is non-existent and who believe that they can prove that the self is non-existent fall into the mistake of empiricism, which is basically asserting that you can prove you know a thing is certainly true because your experience tells you that it's true. But I do think that one needs to invoke the existence of the self and of free will at an emergent level to explain the world.
I think we're still very much at the early stages of arbitraging two opportunities. First is what I'll call this gap between the geographical and digital zip code that you occupy. You're a prime example of this. You live in India, and yet you got access to icons in Silicon Valley, created relationships with them, and were able to work with them. And the second interrelated piece that enabled that is what I'll call credential or proof of work arbitrage. Historically, it's been all about your resume, your LinkedIn profile, and now it's more about this proof of work that you put on the internet and use as a beacon to attract and demonstrate yourself to like-minded people. And a footnote here is that you're only 17 and were able to create that body of work. What do you feel like you know about arbitraging these two opportunities that others don't and should embrace more?
I think I live in a very different world compared to my parents when they were my age. And I think you're spot on about the opportunity right now for anyone with a phone and internet connection. The possibilities are quite literally endless. I'd say what worked for me is being authentic and vocal about my ideas, just publishing on the internet and publishing where people actually consume content. I learned the hard way that if you start a blog and write a post every single day, no matter how good the content, nobody's going to find it if you don't promote it. So try to write or speak or create where people actually consume content. This could be X, LinkedIn, Medium, Substack, or AirChat. And then secondly, what really helped was sliding into people's DMs more. I realized that if you're genuine and concise and curious, people will respond. And even if they don't, it just takes 5 minutes to write a good cold DM or email. So just talking to people, building a network. And I think that's a good way to play the great online game.
Assuming that you left AirChat tomorrow and had whatever support you needed to start your own venture, which I'm sure Naval and Brian will give you when you're ready, what are the top 1 to 3 big quests or problems you'd want to work on and why?
A couple of broad problems that are really exciting to me are longevity, which is basically lifespan extension, and the education problem, which we somewhat discussed. So I'd really dig deep into those spaces and try to find a niche problem that I can solve profitably while helping make progress in the general field, because I think it'd be really cool to live at least 1 million years.
Both are fascinating spaces. Obviously, I'm a bit biased to education given my background, but also very interested in longevity. I'm going to challenge you to go a bit deeper here. What might be the immediate problems you would solve in each of those spaces or the wedges to enter them?
So one would think that with so much knowledge freely abundant on the internet and basically the Library of Alexandria and the palm of our hands, we should have revolutionized the education system till now, but the conventional system just hasn't made any progress over the last few decades. So I definitely think school serves a function in society. Yes, it's antithetical to learning and it's coercive, but the fact is millions of parents send their kids to school every day. We touched on this topic before, but the reality is just that parents can't devote 24 hours a day to their children, and they can't take their kids to their offices. So the school becomes kind of like a daycare for children, but there's a lot of bad things and bad philosophy that comes attached to it. So I think the internet is great, but I think the best approach, and the most likely approach that children might prefer themselves, and obviously this is not speaking for everybody, individuals might differ, but I think what broadly might be true and that entrepreneurs could rely on making profits from is that an approach where there's basically a fusion of activities and learning on the internet with real life activities and socialization. So I mentioned Chris Turner before, and I think what he's doing with Moonrise is great, and I expect to see more startups of that kind emerging as the demand for an alternative to the conventional indoctrination of the system increases. Basically creating better environments for people between the ages of 5 and 16 to learn, meet people, and grow with no fixed curriculum, where children are basically encouraged to follow their own curiosity. They can go home anytime, eat lunch anytime. So that one problem of basically creating better spaces for kids, that's what comes to mind immediately in education. And in the field of longevity, honestly, I'm not sure what problem I'd like to tackle as of now. I think cryonics is very interesting, but ideally you don't have to get to that stage of cryopreserving your body. I guess I'll wedge into the broader field of longevity by reading more and talking to the smartest people working in that space that usually opens doors.
I ask all guests the same closing question, which is to flip it around on you. What's one question you'd leave me and listeners with to think about or act on?
One question that's been helpful for me to ponder, which could also be helpful for you and your audience, is what plans are you still working on that past you thought up as a good idea, but which no longer represent your present interests?